Contented Media presents Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, an original podcast series with Mark Hunter and Arthur Van Pelt.
Hello and welcome to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, the podcast that every month dons its hazmat suit, checks its head torch, grabs its Geiger counter, and heads into the nuclear wasteland of BSV to see if there's anything still alive there. My name is Mark Hunter, crypto writer and scorer of a hat-trick in the Dads vs. Kids end-of-year school football match, thank you fans, and with me as usual to help with this month's search for the most noteworthy artifact from the BSV debris is Arthur Van Pelt. Hello, sir.
Hey, Mark. Good to be back again. Mm-hmm. You know, these recordings twice a month for the Dr. Bitcoin podcast are becoming so much part of a pattern that makes me feel so happy, comfortable, and being part of an amazing story that deserves a much wider audience than it is getting now. One day, movies will be made about the Craig Wright saga, don't you think so, Mark?
Oh, absolutely. And hopefully they will end with him in a jumpsuit. We can only wish.
Yes, sir.
As usual, we start in Lawsuit Corner and the saga of the 1.977 form, which took a delightful twist this month as we finally saw what the fuss was all about. The form, which has been subject to much back and forth since Ira Kleiman's team filed for its completion in January, was finally opened up for public consumption this month, and it didn't disappoint. Before we get into the reason why this was done and what was in it, Arthur, please could you remind us of the purpose of the form and why Craig Wright debunkers were so looking forward to seeing it?
Yeah, well, to keep this that as simple as possible, this thing is actually called a fact information sheet, and it is officially known as either Form 1977 or Form 7343, depending on the situation. These forms allow the judgment creditor, and in this case it is WNK, represented by Ira Kleiman, to perform a consolidated discovery on Craig Wright's assets and learn about his exact financial situation. And this certainly helps Ira and his counsel to understand how to best proceed with the debt collection of $143 million that was judged, already more than a year ago by now. And we were all looking forward to seeing the content of this form of Craig Wright, because Craig Wright has built a substantial list of conflicting stories about all his assets. And since this form 1977 that he was supposed to fill in, it is also supposed to be provided under oath when he is handing it over, in theory at least, so it will give a higher level of trust. Not that Craig Wright cares about these nuances, of course, but at least we would potentially see a list of assets that Craig Wright currently sees as his possessions and being part of his wealth. So would the Satoshi Bitcoins be on that list? Would the 1FIX and 12 IB7 Bitcoin addresses from the Pineapple Head lawsuit be on this list? The Tulip Trust and Enchain and SV Pool and properties in Australia that he always claimed to own on his name? Things like that. Will they be on this Form 1977?
Those Wright debunkers were, inevitably, to be disappointed. As Ira's lead counsel, Val Friedman, had hinted on Twitter, Wright, in keeping with his chicanery over the $143 million owed to W&K, filled out the form in the barest senses of the words, refusing to include basic information such as his phone number, address of his employer, social security number, and driver's license, where he simply put, quote, not USA, unquote. He simply crossed a line through the entire spousal section rather than filling it in as Florida law requires, because he's Craig Wright and foreign laws don't apply to him, except copyright ones, of course. When asked to list his children's names and ages, he simply put, quote, all adult, unquote. He ignored all instructions to list his bank account details. He said that all his property and vehicles were not, quote, personally owned, unquote, and that all such assets were in trusts. Sounds familiar. And then claimed that it is he who is in fact owed money from two sources. Ira Kleiman, who owes him $10.9 million over, quote, judgment, debt, failure to pay, unquote, and Peter McCormack, who still apparently owes him £1 from last year's libel judgment. Arthur, this latter point was added on a supplementary sheet which went some way to explaining the lack of information in the form. What else did we learn from this sheet?
Oh, well, Mark, I'm happy to read it in full, because it's not long, but it's very entertaining in the sense that we learn how Craig Wright is currently making a mess of his life. You can really see him digging a hole where he will not be able to get out of.
Hmm.
On top of that page, it says list of assets owned personally. Two judgment debts issued against W&K Infodense, LLC, Australian dollar 196,000 or million. It's a bit hard to say what he means there because it's a pretty weird number. 196,684,42290.
What?
Yeah, I have no idea what that number exactly means. It should be something in Australian dollars, but it does not make much sense to me. Does he mean here 196 million? Now 196,000? No idea.
No.
Then he continues to explain that number. Dr. Craig S. Wright was assigned two judgments from the Supreme Court of New South Wales on November the 6th, 2013, against W&K Info Defence Research LLC. Now he knows how to spell the name of that company right. This does not include the remaining amount owing to the creditor from the debtor, W&K, on the date hereof is, and another super duper crazy number appears now, 10,650,872,609 dollars.
What is that? Where's he pulling these numbers from?
Yeah, nee, exactly. No idea what is going on here. We will still expect some responses from Ira Kleiman. They will probably ask questions about it before there will be a contempt hearing. And then they will probably go into the details of these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's continue. Bank accounts are not personally owned and are formally assigned from 2017 to other parties.
He has no bank account.
Yeah, this appears pretty weird to me that you don't have a bank account on your own name anymore.
Everyone does everything for him. That's ludicrous.
That is ridiculous. That is, I think, practically impossible. How do you pay your own bill when you are abroad, when you go to a conference? No idea how that works. Maybe he's taking a credit card from Enchain and they will pull that from his salary, but his salary should go to his bank account. Then his salary goes to his wife, probably. No idea how that works. But again, we will learn those details later at the contempt hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then he has a sentence about his vehicles. All vehicles were transferred under assignment to other parties in 2017, leaving a mere right to use. So he doesn't own any cars. All real property was transferred in full or equity in 2014 or earlier. I think he means real estate and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably he also means the Bitcoin here.
Ah, potentially.
But we can't be sure because it is not mentioned.
Yeah.
I hate making guesses. When something is not there, then you start asking questions. Where is your Bitcoin? Under what section is that falling?
Mm.
Or did you just not mention it? You forgot to mention it?
Yeah.
Now, then he is mentioning that a judgment debt from Peter McCormack of £1 remains outstanding.
That's a lie, isn't it?
That is a lie. That is exactly because Peter McCormack showed the evidence that has been paid. So this is a clear lie on this form. Now, then Craig Wright says, the last thing he is saying on that form, all other assets were formally transferred, including rights and ongoing payments, as of October 2015. Yeah, maybe the Bitcoins are falling under here.
It's all so vague, isn't it?
It's, of course, very vague. Yeah.
Intentionally so.
Of course. Yeah, of course, of course. So, yeah, here you go, Mark. Craig is trying to hide literally all his assets behind a smokescreen of what I consider lies.
We now turn to the reason why this form was made public, Judge Reinhardt's order. This order was in response to demands made by Ira Kleiman's team that the form, which had been marked attorney's eyes only, be published unredacted so that the world could see Wright's charlatanism firsthand, and that Wright be held in contempt of court for his lack of cooperation. Arthur, please remind us what action Ira's legal team wanted against Wright.
Oh, that was quite something, Mark. That was a serious list of sanctions and remedies that they requested.
Hmm.
Judge Reinhardt summarized this list in his order as follows. Number one, a temporary restraining order prohibiting any dissipation of assets held by any entity that Wright controls, directly or indirectly, or that Wright is a beneficiary of, directly or indirectly. Number two, sanctions of no less than $250,000 per day. Number three, a freeze on all accounts that make payments to Wright or on behalf of Wright, that includes all accounts used to pay attorney fees. And number four, an award of W&K attorney's fees incurred for all past and future post-judgment litigation. Now, all in all, this is quite serious.
I like number three because, like we've just said, he could easily say, oh, I haven't got any bank accounts myself, nothing's in my name. So they're trying to go after the accounts that pay his legal fees, which, of course, you know, forces them to reveal who they are and then stops them being paid. So I think they've got no chance with number two, with the $250,000 a day. But if number three could come off, that could be quite a big one, actually.
What we will see happen then is that bank accounts belonging to entities related to Calvin Air are coming into the picture. Mm-hmm. And when I think about that, I immediately think of a racketeering, a RICO case type of thing. That would mean, which is, if you ask me, a good thing, then Calvin Air is getting involved. He is the guy with the money so far. And if Al Friedman wants to make a chance of obtaining any money from someone, then he should not go chase Craig Wright too much, but go look deeper in his sugar daddy.
If that were to happen, I wonder if that would drive a wedge between him and Craig Wright, because Calvin Air has managed to keep a distance from the lawsuits so far. He funds them in the background through various BSV vehicles, as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But if that were to come off, this is a very direct impact on him, isn't it? And it would be the most satisfying case of chickens coming home to roost I think I'd have ever heard about.
He is hiding behind entities, for example, Rockwallet, the mother company of Rockwallet. It's also something Rock blah blah blah, but it's headquartered on, no surprises here,
Antigua.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And it was exposed that the mother company of Rockwallet is paying the bills for Kleiman versus Wright lawsuit, which means that Calvin Air, from one of his own entities, is sending money to the mother company of Rockwallet, and that mother company is then paying the lawyer in America, which is Rivero Mestre. So when they have to freeze a bank account, Calvin Air is still not directly hurt so much.
Yeah.
I mean, he will just raise the next sock puppet company, and he will continue with what he is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you have to start somewhere. And the moment that they are getting closer to Calvin Air, and the judges will think this is going somewhere, and Calvin Air is indeed in RICO style involved with the whole thing, yeah, then this might go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
How and when and where, no idea yet, of course, but this is what makes this case so exciting to follow.
Mm-hmm. On the contempt charge, Wright's argument was that he simply doesn't know who owns his expensive possessions, such as his house and his luxury cars, adding that even if he did know, British law precludes him from handing over such information. His law firm added that the contempt ruling wasn't necessary because the court could, quote, simply order him to provide that information now, unquote, rather than charge him with contempt. This neatly sidesteps the fact that Wright has already been ordered by the court to provide the information and refused, which is why we're here, and in suggesting he can provide it if the court tells him to again, he totally undermines the argument that he couldn't provide the information the first time round. This was addressed by Judge Reinhardt, who said, quote, I reject Dr. Wright's argument that I should defer contempt proceedings until he has a chance to correct any defects in the form. Curing the form now might preclude the court from imposing coercive civil contempt sanctions, but it does not eliminate the possibility of remedial civil contempt or criminal contempt, unquote. Arthur, what else did Judge Reinhardt say about this situation?
Well, if you ask me, he is hinting that if it was to him, contempt has already been proven, because here is what he said. There is prima facie evidence of contemptuous conduct. Most notably, despite Judge Bloom's compulsion order, Dr. Wright refused to provide basic information about his spouse and her assets. A section of the form requires disclosures about the debtor's spouse and the spouse's assets. Dr. Wright identified his spouse by name on the form, but did not provide any of the other required information about her or her assets. He crossed out the relevant portion of the form and wrote N.A. I think that means not available.
Not applicable.
Not applicable, yes, okay. It sounds like that Reinhardt is already making up his mind into a very specific direction, if you ask me.
On the subject of the attorney's eyes only designation, Wright's argument as to why the information in the form shouldn't be made public was all to do with one of Ira Kleiman's legal teams, Friedman Norman Friedland, formerly Roche Friedman, and the infamous Kyle Roche video from last year. This is an issue we've covered many times before, so we don't need to go through it again, save to say that Wright's legal team persists in the argument that Wright's financial information is not safe in their hands. This time, they added another argument, that allowing FNF to share the form, quote, carries far too much risk that Dr. Wright's personal financial information will end up all over the internet, unquote. Of course, as anyone who subsequently read the form following its publication knows, the danger of anything remotely close to personal financial information being divulged was about as risky as burning yourself on a Fisher-Price My First Kitchen playset. As Judge Reinhardt pointed out, the idea that unsealing the form would reveal sensitive financial information was, quote, factually false, unquote. This is because, as we know, Wright divulged less personal information than a gym membership application, with Reinhardt concluding, quote, it does not identify any bank accounts, vehicles, real property, or other assets. It does not identify his spouse's address, birth date, other identifiers, or assets. There is no reasonable interpretation that would support the conclusion that the form reveals sensitive personal financial information, unquote. Arthur, what were the two other points that Judge Reinhardt raised in relation to the contempt issue?
Yeah, Reinhardt wasn't done yet, wasn't he? He said, second, even a cursory review shows that the information of the form cannot be designated as attorney's eyes only under the confidentiality order. It is not trade secrets or highly sensitive non-public commercial financial information or highly sensitive private corporate information relating to any current business in which a party has an interest. Therefore, the designation was improper from the beginning. Third, the purpose of the form is to provide the judgment creditor with information that can be used to collect the debt. It would violate the confidentiality order for a lawyer to disclose AEO, which means attorney's eyes only, information to a non-party who has information about or possession of Dr. Wright's assets. To allow the form to be designated as AEO and thereby preclude WNK from sharing it with necessary non-parties, as Dr. Wright proposes, would effectively render it useless for its intended purpose. So there you go.
Judge Reinhardt also noted that, quote, Dr. Wright's response did not address why the form should remain sealed, so he has abandoned that argument, unquote, all but ensuring that the form would be made public, summarising, quote, the form does not disclose any sensitive confidential information, and Dr. Wright has not articulated a valid, let alone compelling, reason why the form should be sealed, unquote. He ordered the form unsealed, and then, in a show that he was finally reaching the end of his tether with Wright's antics, made another order, quote, it is further ordered that on or before May 18th, 2023, Dr. Wright and his counsel shall show cause why they should not be sanctioned for designating the form as attorney's eyes only, insisting that it be filed under seal and persisting in that position in response to the court's order to show cause, unquote. Arthur, we got a hint here that Judge Reinhardt is also planning to haul Rivero Mestre over the coals too. What was their response to this?
Well, their almost immediate response was that they hired another law firm called Rabin Kammerer Johnson PA to represent themselves. And not just one, but no less than three lawyers of that firm were hired, two of the three founders, Rabin and Kammerer themselves, and a lawyer working at the firm to support them. There must be hundreds of thousands of dollars going to all these legal firms working for Craig Wright each month. And it's pretty obvious that Calvin has not managed to get them to accept BSV. Otherwise, there would have been a massive price floor under the BSV token when Calvin needs to buy BSV every month. But yeah, just kidding here, Mark. We also had this from Judge Reinhardt. It is further ordered that the court will conduct an in-person evidentiary hearing on July 6, 2023 to determine whether to certify facts related to Dr. Wright's alleged non-compliance with the compulsion order to Judge Bloom for further contempt proceedings. If Dr. Wright intends to argue that foreign law prohibits him from disclosing information required by Form 1977, he shall file a memorandum of law on that issue on or before May the 31st of this year. WNK may file a response on or before June the 14th of this year. So we have that to look forward in July, Mark.
We certainly do. I was just thinking as well, this whole thing about Rivero Mestre saying that this financial information on the form needs to be attorneys' eyes only, I'm not sure how the timelines line up, but I get the impression that Craig Wright hadn't filled this form out at all. He hadn't done anything towards it. And so they were trying to say that he can't fill it out because what he will put in there will be attorney's eyes only privileged information. So when the judge ruled he had to do it, he had to rush the form out like afterwards. So Rivero Mestre weren't, I don't think, saying that this information is privileged. They were saying the information he has been asked to put on there will be privileged, not realizing he was going to put all this rubbish in. So I think they're talking at two different things here.
That is my impression too. At least the part of that he indeed did nothing at first. And when he was forced to do something, he hurried and just filled in something that came to his mind last minute.
Rivero Mestre asked for more time for both itself and Craig Wright to respond to Judge Reinhardt's demands, which was granted, with the law firm filing their response on May 24th, deadline day. Andres Rivero explained his defense of Wright's nonsense form as AEO by saying, as was pretty obvious by this point, that he had expected Wright to fill in the form like any normal person would, and so what he would divulge would be classed as sensitive financial information. Quote, "Because I was not directly involved in the AEO designation, I did not consult the terms of the original confidentiality order. It is my experience, however, that personal financial information is precisely the sort of information that typically is protected by a confidentiality order. Rivero Mestre's decision to designate as AEO was driven by the normally confidential nature of income information, the intense media attention given to this case, and our concern about the history of the firm's statements on social media about developments in this case, especially because of the admissions made by Mr. Roche on video. Our failure to appreciate that the confidentiality order in this case was more narrowly drawn than is usual was an oversight and not intentional or in bad faith." Unquote. As we know, of course, what Wright in fact produced was a boatload of drivel, which Rivero Mestre was forced to defend as privileged information even after it had seen the contents of the form. Wright's argument, which was due on May 25th, arrived in a manner that summed up his recent approach to the post-judgment dealings in this case. On the day he was supposed to explain why the information in the form should be privileged, a filing arrived from Rivero Mestre simply saying, quote, "Craig Wright submits this notice that he adopts the response filed by his counsel, Rivero Mestre LLP, in response to the court's May 5th, 2023 order to show cause," unquote. A further filing the same day attempted to offer some clarification on the matter. Quote, "The decision to designate the financial information statement as attorney's eyes only was made by Rivero Mestre LLP. Dr. Wright played no part in making the designation," unquote. There's a good law firm. This month, we got hold of not one, not two, but three filings relating to the Pineapple Hack case, in which Wright claims that Tulip Trading Limited, TTL, lost over $1 billion worth of coins in that hack. These were the defences filed by the collection of Bitcoin developers, the two Bitcoin Cash, now eCash, developers, Jason Cox and Amari Sachet, and Roger Ver. It has been a mammoth effort to compile the three defences into one narrative and match them up against Wright's claims, and so we're going to dedicate June's bonus episode to a full breakdown. However, it's certainly worth going through some of the highlights in this month's update so we can get an idea of what the defendants think of Wright's claims. Right off the bat, we get a flavour for how this case is going to be fought, with the Bitcoin developers making their case clear from the outset. Quote, "This is a fraudulent claim. TTL does not own the digital assets it claims to own in these proceedings and has never owned them. TTL has made a deliberately false claim to ownership of those assets and has commenced these proceedings knowing that it has no claim in respect of those assets. The claim is accordingly an abuse of the court's process." Unquote. Similarly, the eCash developers didn't mess about when it came to their opening gambit. Quote, "The claim is both fraudulent and legally misconceived. The claimant seeks an order intended to give it ownership of cryptocurrency worth billions of US dollars, alternatively damages or equitable compensation in that sum. It never owned or controlled that cryptocurrency in the first place, and the evidence on which it relies is manufactured." Unquote. Arthur, Roger Ver didn't start with a summary dismissal of Wright's claims. He offered something altogether more spectacular, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. It is pretty clear that Roger Ver and Craig Wright are absolutely no friends anymore, Mark. And that shows indeed in a quite spectacular defense of him. No less than 6 pages are spent on describing Craig's false and fraudulent antics all over the world, from his company Tulip Trading Limited to, and that part is no less than 5.5 pages long, all kinds of court dealings over the years where Craig was found a liar and a fraud, in summary. And, of course, his whole claim of ever having owned the 1 Feeks and 12 IB7 addresses with, in total, 110,000 coins. And for Roger Ver, his network, that is the BCH token, is being rejected by Roger.
Ver also got personal with regard to his relationship with Wright, saying that Wright has a, quote, long-standing personal animosity, unquote, towards him, and has described Ver as his enemy, as well as making, quote, a series of disparaging and defamatory comments, unquote, about Ver. Naturally, all three filings include denials that Wright is Satoshi Nakamoto, with Ver saying that this is merely Wright's alter ego rather than his pseudonym, which I thought was a nice touch. Ver and the eCash developers all state that, rather than Wright being renowned for being Satoshi Nakamoto, he is in fact renowned as, quote, an individual who claims to be Satoshi Nakamoto, unquote, adding that, quote, the renown which it is alleged Dr. Wright enjoys is denied, unquote. Arthur, what did the Bitcoin developers have to say about Wright's Satoshi claims?
Oh, please listen, Mark, this is so good. I'll quote. Dr. Wright is not Satoshi and did not create the Bitcoin system. In particular, Dr. Wright's claim that he is Satoshi has been discredited in the cryptocurrency community. Dr. Wright has displayed ignorance of obvious matters concerning the Bitcoin system, of which the inventor of the system, which is the real Satoshi, whoever that is, would not be ignorant. As examples of this, paragraphs 44.2 and 46.1 below are repeated. Now, Mark, note that I just mentioned two paragraph numbers, 44.2 and 46.1, and these are so good, so I will read them to you also. It is denied that the use of private keys prevent double counting. As the inventor of Bitcoin would know, the feature of the Bitcoin system, which allows double spends to be prevented in the decentralized setting, is proof of work. Craig Wright says that private keys prevent double counting or double spending. No, and that is, of course, not correct. The other paragraph says, the reasons why a private key is required to transfer Bitcoin include the following, of which it is inferred the inventor of Bitcoin, Satoshi, would be aware. It is inherent in the design of the Bitcoin system that the user's private keys are required to undertake a transaction. It would be inconsistent with the foundational principles of the Bitcoin system to permit access to coins without the private key. If Dr. Wright were Satoshi, it would be easy for him to attempt to prove that, for example, by releasing the original document of the white paper that Satoshi published in 2008, or the pre-release builds of Bitcoin.exe, or using the relevant private key to sign a message on the Genesis block or any of the public addresses known to be controlled by Satoshi, mm-hmm. or releasing the original private correspondence between Satoshi and other members of the community, or signing a message with Satoshi's well-known PGP key. However, Dr. Wright has not done so because it is to be inferred that he is not Satoshi. So yeah, amen to that, Mark. Craig Wright at his best. He has no idea how Bitcoin works, and especially who do know how Bitcoin works, it becomes so easy to pinpoint and expose his inconsistencies. And that's exactly what the Bitcoin developers have been doing in their defense.
The Bitcoin developers then hit Wright where it hurts, his qualifications, and their arguments are worth reading out in full. Quote, Dr. Wright does not have a computer science degree. Dr. Wright does not have the ability to code C++. Alternatively, does not have anything beyond the ability of a beginner. Dr. Wright failed his theory of computation course in his information systems security program at Charles Sturt University. The theory of computation course was the only true computer science course in the curriculum. Dr. Wright does not have a significant publication history or impact factor in computer science journals. Dr. Wright's claims to renown are heavily disputed in the cryptocurrency and scientific communities. Dr. Wright has, in other proceedings, given deliberately false evidence as to matters concerning his scientific standing, such as invitations to academic conferences and the supposed acceptance of academic papers following peer review. It is to be inferred that he is not a renowned computer scientist because such a person would not give, or need to give, false evidence about their standing in the scientific community. Unquote. Arthur, are we to infer from this that the Bitcoin developers have got hold of some extra evidence that stands these allegations up?
Yeah, I think you can be assured of that, Mark. There's evidence for each and every single point on this list. And as it happens, I just tweeted out the screenshot of Craig's Charles Sturt diploma, where indeed the line with theory of computation has been set to a zero, which means completely failed. And the text that I tweeted out was... While Satoshi was coding up Bitcoin in 2007 and 2008, showcasing substantial experience in computer science, Craig Wright was meanwhile still following IT courses touching on computer science, but he failed theory of computation, which is the only computer science course that he had at that moment.
Jesus.
So this con man now claims that Bitcoin is Turing complete. Well, everybody knows it isn't, but he keeps on saying that Bitcoin is Turing complete. Well, but not to brag, Mark, but this tweet went a little viral in the hours after I posted it. I'm no doubt if I have that information, all the Bitcoin developers have all that information too, because almost all of that the information is public anyway. Yeah. Because, for example, the university paper came from Craig Wright's own blog, buried deep away in his wheelbarrow of qualifications.
Ver signed off his opening statements by denying Wright's suggestion of BSV being Bitcoin and everything else before and since being airdrops, saying, quote, the use of the term airdrop to refer to a hard fork is contentious and apt to mislead because the term airdrop is commonly used to refer to the practice of an unsolicited distribution of a digital token. The allegation that the BCH network, whatever that is intended to mean, is not a legitimate network of Bitcoin, whatever that is intended to mean, is vague, imprecise, and denied. Dr. Wright is a vocal proponent of Bitcoin BSV. It appears that this litigation is motivated by Dr. Wright's desire to discredit alternative Bitcoin software. Unquote. You're not wrong, Roger. The Bitcoin developers ended their initial arguments against the first part of Wright's particulars of claim by saying that it amounted to an abusive process. Quote, it is averred that this claim is an abusive process because it has been bought by TTL fraudulently in the knowledge that it has no claim. As to this, Dr. Wright and TTL do not have and have never had an interest of any kind in the digital assets in the addresses. Dr. Wright and TTL must necessarily have known this and did know it. This claim is an abusive process because Dr. Wright and TTL have known at all material times that TTL has no claim. Unquote. On the subject of nodes, all three defendants unsurprisingly disagree with Wright's contention that only miners can be classed as nodes, and, even more unsurprisingly, also disagreed that the developers have a fiduciary duty to coin holders, which of course is at the heart of the case. Roger Ver went as far as aligning himself with the Craig Wright School of Coding, saying that he, Ver, quote, learned rudimentary coding skills at high school, but does not have the knowledge or experience to make changes to the BCH software or any other similar software, unquote. Arthur, what did the Bitcoin and eCash developers say about Wright's claims that they were in control of their respective networks?
Well, in short, of course, the developers make the, in my opinion, extremely legit argument that, for example, and these are from the people from eCash, they say neither the 15 nor 16 defendant, whether alone or together, controls the eCash blockchain. Now, and if we then move on to the Bitcoin developers, they tackle the same issue in more detail by saying in their defense, the ability to control the BTC GitHub does not give the person who has such control the ability to control the BTC network or to require nodes in the BTC network to use the software on the BTC GitHub or any other software. The BTC network is controlled by all the Bitcoin users through the selection of the consensus rules that their computers apply, which is the node software that they choose to run. Each user of the BTC network chooses and controls the software that they use. There is no restriction in the BTC network on the software that may be used by nodes in order to form part of the network. Bitcoin Core and other BTC network software do not use automatic or forced updates. Now, and this is clear as day. This is indeed exactly how Bitcoin is working. So what Craig Wright is expecting from the Bitcoin developers, they might be able to do something, but it is not on the Bitcoin developers to force their changes, their updates upon the nodes, and there are 10,000 of them, Mark, make no mistake.
Is that kind of thing going to be quite hard to prove to a judge, do you think? Because if you've got Craig Wright saying one thing and the defendant saying another, you know, apart from the white paper, is there any proof that can be offered to back up their side of things?
Yeah, there is a beautiful example of the user-activated soft fork in 2017. That was a beautiful example of how developers made several improvement proposals. They were all suggested to the network, and it ended up that in early, I think, February or March 2017, it was Sharelyn Fry, the developer, who made the best proposal, and his BIP ended up with SegWit and a few other things. That ended up being accepted by the totality of the network.
Of course, what most observers really want to hear about is the supposed hack on Wright's systems and whether the defendants have been able to ascertain if it actually happened or not. First, however, we need to tackle the ownership, or otherwise, of the two addresses in question. The address beginning 1FEEX, known as 1FEEX, and the address beginning 12IB7. Arthur, first off, what do Wright and the three defendants say when it comes to the 12IB7 address?
Well, Craig simply states in his particulars of claim that he owns the address, and then I quote, and various transactions were undertaken on the 12IB7 address over the period of 13 May 2010 to 25 of July 2010, leaving a net amount of 31,000 Bitcoin, end of quote. So basically, that proves nothing at all, as anyone can make that same claim and look up on any block explorer what happened on that address in the past. So you will see the developers react as one would expect. For example, the Bitcoin developers, here they are again, they reminded Craig of the fact that he couldn't prove ownership of the 12IB7 address back in the days when he was struggling with his ATO tax fraud. And here I quote again from their defense. In the course of an investigation by the Australian Tax Office, Dr. Wright was asked by the ATO to prove control of Bitcoin at the 1FEEX and 12IB7 addresses by using the message signing feature. The owner of Bitcoin at those addresses would have been able to do this, but Dr. Wright failed to do so. Now, then Roger Ver's counsel, on the other hand, is keeping it a bit more high level. They just summarize what Craig is claiming around the addresses and the hack in 2020, and they then wipe it from the table with a simple, all such assertions are false and are made dishonestly.
No, it's short and to the point, isn't it?
Yeah, very to the point. Now, then the eCash developers, they detail their critics a bit further. TTL has failed to particularize when and how it claims to have taken ownership of the coin in the 12IB7 address. TTL did not exist in 2010. That is indeed correct. It was an empty shelf company raised in July 2011, so that company could not have done anything in 2010 with the 12IB7 address, of course. And we know from other sources and other cases that Tulip Trading Limited was an empty shelf company bought by Craig Wright in October 2014. For a very different thing at that moment. He was busy with a scheme where he tried to avoid paying 1.6 million something Australian dollar in GST tax. Mm-hmm. And that's why he needed a trust to push his Bitcoin to. Now, okay, very convoluted story, of course, but if you follow our podcast, you will know a little bit about these things. But when it comes to this case, the Pineapple Hack case, the 12IB7 address is supposed to be in that company, TTL. And when we look at the transactions on that 12IB7 address, they happened mostly and only in 2010, which means the TTL has nothing to do with something in 2010 because it didn't even exist yet. Now, and that is a point. It's a good point that the eCash developers are making. So yeah, all in all, Craig is put to strict proof to show why his claims are true. And the existing material that Craig has added to the particulars of claim did indeed not convince anyone.
Of course, the story surrounding the OneFeeks address is entirely different and much more convoluted. For a detailed breakdown of this address and its history, check out Series 1, Episodes 5 and 7 of this podcast and our OneFeeks update from December 2021. The key things to know are that Wright claims he bought the 79,956 Bitcoin through Russian currency exchange WMIRK, which didn't deal in Bitcoin at the time, in late February 2011, and had the coins delivered to the OneFeeks address. Wright says he arranged this over the phone, handily leaving no email trail, with a purchase order written up by Wright's then-wife Lynn purportedly backing the purchase. Wright says that WMIRK agreed to take Liberty Reserve dollars in return for the Bitcoin, with the coins delivered the same day as a known hack on the Mt. Gox exchange saw an identical number of coins leave Mt. Gox for the OneFeeks wallet, an event Wright says didn't happen. Arthur, what did the defendants think about the claim that Wright purchased the OneFeeks address and had the coins delivered to it?
Yeah, as said before, these stories are basically fully rejected by all defendants. But let's dive into the defense of the Bitcoin developers, as they are the most detailed about why they reject Craig's claims around the OneFeeks address. First of all, the Bitcoin developers completely reject the February 2011 WMIRK purchase order that is supposed to be the bombshell evidence that Craig purchased the almost 80,000 tokens on the OneFeeks address. And now I quote from their defense. The purchase order submitted by Dr. Wright in these proceedings, purportedly as evidence of the alleged purchase of the Bitcoin at the OneFeeks address, is a forgery. The purported purchase order is based on a free online template that was released in 2015, 4 years after the alleged purchase. Now, oops. And then they mentioned a few flaws on the order itself. So I quote again. The address listed in the purchase order is lowercase. And then they mean the Bitcoin address. Since Bitcoin addresses are case sensitive, this particular address is invalid and would not have worked. The OneFeeks address with the lowercase f at the end does not and cannot exist. It is an invalid address because addresses contain a built-in checksum such that only certain combinations are valid, and the address with the lowercase f at the end is not such a combination. So there you have it, Mark. Again, Craig Wright is struggling with checksum, a feature that Satoshi Nakamoto himself built in into Bitcoin, mind you.
He would have known about it.
Oh my God, this is so beautiful. Well, and then it continues with several more flaws on the purchase order. So I'll continue with the quote. It states that there is a mining fee of $75. But no such fee is shown on the BTC blockchain. It states that 80,000 Bitcoin was purchased, but the BTC blockchain shows only 79,956 Bitcoin to have been transferred. Now you have to realize one thing, Mark. Craig Wright, or Lynn Wright, if we have to believe Craig's claim, because he claims that it is her purchase order. This purchase order was thoroughly forensically inquired by Alex Partners, a firm hired by Ontier, before they threw this purchase order file over the fence to the developers. Alex Partners wrote a report about the file with all the details of the file and how they inquired it and why they endorsed it as a genuine February 2011 purchase order file. So now the Bitcoin developers basically claim that Alex Partners didn't do their homework properly, as they think that the file was created in or after 2015. And yes, that was when Lynn Wright was not around anymore, as they divorced somewhere around early 2012. Hmm. So it would be a massive oopsie for both Craig Wright and Alex Partners in the lawsuit if the developers can come up with proper evidence of their claims. And believe me, Mark, they can.
Excellent stuff. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
The defendants then turned to the hack, which Wright claims was an Ocean's 11-style breach of his home network that took place in February 2020. All three defences were as unequivocal in their dismissal of the hack as they had been with Wright's ownership of the coins in the first place, all denying that it ever took place. Given that Wright has never furnished the defendants with a police report, despite apparently filing one, information on the incident itself is scant, but the defendants are in no doubt that there is no way a gang broke into Wright's home, planted the Pineapple Wi-Fi device, and stole 37 gigabytes worth of data before deleting it all. As well as the denial of the hack, all three defences raised interesting points regarding certain details of the event. Arthur, the eCash developers pointed out that nowhere in Wright's filings does he actually say that the keys were definitely stolen before the data was allegedly wiped. He only says it's to be, quote, inferred, unquote, that they were stolen. Is he seriously basing this entire case on a mere presumption?
Well, yeah, it appears so, Mark. Now imagine you have a car, let's say a Mercedes, and it's located in front of your house, and then you claim your car keys have been stolen, but at the same time the car never moved, it's still in front of your house. Hmm. And then you sue the Mercedes factory to destroy the car in front of your house and then to give you a new Mercedes car. Yes, you get that right. Craig is not requesting new private keys to the existing Bitcoin and fork tokens. He is requesting that the actual coins from the 2010 and 2011 era are being frozen and made unusable, and that new tokens are being minted on chain and are handed to him with a new private key. And this will be high level a very interesting case for the judges. But low level, we will get into details like fiduciary duties of the developers, Bitcoin and its forks being decentralized or not, consensus with 10,000s of nodes when we talk about Bitcoin, etc., etc. And in that sense, from that angle, it's a very interesting case too. But I always follow up with that it's a damn pity that individual developers have to be in the stress about this almost never-ending legal struggle. And luckily, the Bitcoin Legal Defense Fund was raised last year by Jack Dorsey, and it was confirmed again that the Bitcoin developers, and as far as I understand, not the eCash and not Roger Ver, can use the Legal Defense Funds, because Jack Dorsey is only sponsoring the, the real Bitcoin developers, which is the largest group of the lawsuit anyway, but still. So that must be a massive relief for these developers, as litigation, and especially against Craig Wright, who appeals literally anything and everything in his lawsuits, is very, very costly.
It is, it is. I'm just thinking about your Mercedes analogy. It's actually worse than that, because he's not saying that the keys were stolen. We now know he's saying that the keys were probably stolen, but he can't say for sure, and that's enough to get him the new car. That's it. We're at that level.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Now, Roger Ver also took Wright to task on the fact that the keys were allegedly stored in encrypted format on two cloud backup services, Google Cloud and Microsoft OneDrive. Arthur, would someone who believes himself to be one of the world's foremost IT security consultants really store private keys to $1 billion worth of assets with not one but two cloud service providers?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't pretend to be a highly qualified cybersecurity expert.
I don't think you need to be an expert, to be honest with you.
Yeah, nay, I mean, yeah, I do have a few decades of IT experience behind my name, and it's not rocket science to understand that when it is about safely storing a multi-billion worth stash of digital assets for multiple years using cloud services that can go offline any minute of the day should not be on top of your mind, if you ask me.
To this end, Ver pointed out something important. Quote, "Cloud-based backup systems have features that enable deleted data to be restored. Further, users of cloud-based backup systems can request deleted data to be restored." Somehow, Wright and all those who advised him after the hack neglected to mention this. Either this, or they did, but he didn't do it. Of course, had he recovered the keys this way, there would have been no need for the lawsuit, and Wright would have missed a chance to test his theory that court orders can move coins. C'est la vie. All three defendants also had something to say about Wright's decision to wipe his system following the hack, which is one of the first things the UK Cyber Police would have instructed him not to do had he contacted them first. In wiping his system, Wright destroyed any chance the Cyber Police may have had of tracing the hackers. C'est la vie. Again. Ver summed up his thoughts on this, saying, quote, "The explanation as to how Dr. Wright failed on TTL's case to ensure that private keys to valuable assets were backed up is incredible. It is inconceivable on TTL's case that Dr. Wright, as someone who professes to have IT skills and particular expertise in IT security, did not take steps to secure or to restore the backups of such materials immediately upon becoming aware that the private keys and or means of access to the private keys to the tokens at the 1Feeks and 12ib7 addresses had been deleted, together with other information and assets which Dr. Wright claims was stolen from him and others." For their part, the Bitcoin Cash developers cast doubt on whether Wright actually did report the hack to the police. Quote, "To the extent that Dr. Wright reported the alleged misappropriation to the Surrey police, which is not admitted, this was a false claim. TTL has also failed to particularise the outcome of any investigation carried out by Surrey police." Unquote. Now, I've been having my own conversations with Surrey police over this, and here's what they said when I asked them for an update on this case. Quote, "Following a thorough investigation, it has since been filed. Should any new information come to light, this will be looked at accordingly." Unquote. When I pushed for information on this, in particular why they hadn't appealed for witnesses or why they'd kept Britain's biggest heist to themselves, they replied, quote, "All investigations are different and not all investigations are made public or have a need to be made public, whether that be by way of an appeal or other means. We wouldn't go into the specifics of why a case was or wasn't made public, so wouldn't look to provide further guidance in relation to this particular case." Unquote. Of course, we would argue that there most certainly is a need for this to be made public, but for whatever reason, the Surrey police seem keen to bury this and do nothing more until further evidence lands in their lap. Can't think why. When it comes to fiduciary duty, the story from all three defendants was the same. Developers cannot be held responsible for users' coins. They do not have the overwhelming control over the network that Craig Wright says they have, and they have no way of stopping or reversing fraudulent transactions. Arthur, even if the judges rule that the defendants do have a fiduciary duty over blockchain users, Wright isn't going to get the remedy he actually seeks, is he?
No, it's extremely unlikely, yes, and I can say that with 100% certainty about Bitcoin. The forks of Bitcoin, I can't really tell, as they are much smaller and at the same time more centralized. And when it comes to BSV, for example, there is no decentralization at all. Hmm. So BSV already built a notary tool to support the new consensus model of what we call proof of court order. And I mean, they are not even involved in this part of the lawsuit anymore. They settled and built a notary tool last year.
Yeah.
So it was all a scheme to prove to a judge that compliance with court orders is technically possible for a blockchain project. Yes, if you are highly centralized around one or a few people, then it is certainly possible to go against the Bitcoin white paper again. I mean, remember, the Bitcoin white paper talks about no trusted third parties several times, and developer a tool that is freezing and confiscating coins on that blockchain. As said, for Bitcoin this won't work, And with BCH and eCash, it's hard to say for me if this would work. In a sense, they are mini versions of Bitcoin. And how hard it would be to keep up appearances of decentralizations, I don't know, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. That's fair enough. So given that he has pretty much zero chance of getting his coins back on the Bitcoin network, at least, and his actions could end up leading to open source developers in any sphere, really, being held responsible for any kind of loss suffered by anyone using their software. What exactly is his like overall goal here?
Well, let me say this about that high level. Craig Wright has basically only one aim: keep the money flow going from Kelvin Air to himself. This convoluted cryptocurrency scam with a Satoshi cosplay mixed in is only meant to enrich Craig Wright. Full stop. So at all times, Craig needs to keep this clown train on the rails to show Kelvin and the rest of the world that he is still the big guy that Kelvin sees in him. And part of the clown show is Craig, his claim that Bitcoin is supposed to work under and will abide by any law, by any court order and things like that. But it's just a, well, for me at least, a partly lame excuse to get his dirty hands on the Satoshi stash and on the 1FIX and 12IB7 coins to get rich and be able to pay back the loans that he received from Kelvin Air with the Tulip Trust. And don't get me going about that totally fake trust mark as a collateral.
Yeah, you're probably right. There's nothing more complicated than that at the end of the day, I suppose.
Yeah.
So overall then, we've got a very strong rebuttal from the Bitcoin developers, the eCash developers, and Roger Ver over every single element of Craig Wright's claims. And all three have demanded that TTL prove beyond doubt that it owned the coins in the first place and that the hack took place. Arthur, I take it you're looking forward to seeing how Craig Wright tries to prove this in court.
Oh yeah, for sure. I made it no secret when this lawsuit was kicked out from the courts and Craig appealed. And Craig won that appeal so he could continue with his lawsuit based on the merits of it. I was actually, well, one hand, not happy for the developers, of course, because they will have some stress about this thing. On the other hand, when it comes to the merits itself, I was happy that it continued, because we have a classic Craig Wright lawsuit here again with all the Fiktoshi drama elements. Mm. We have lies, we have forgeries, we have false and perjurious declarations, we have complicit lawyers who will be thrown under the bus at some point again. So it's a joy to follow again.
There's a couple of things that don't come up in these defenses that are worth considering here. First, the 1FIX address was the address that Wright used to secure a $15 million bailout in 2015. And we learned recently that a paper copy of this 1FIX address might actually be sitting in a Singapore bank vault. Do you think that this Singapore bank vault story is true, or do you think it's all made up along with the emails that back it up?
Yeah, good question, Mark. To be honest, I have no idea. I would just request evidence and strict proof, as they call it, of all this nonsense. And that's what the developers are constantly doing. So let's see what comes of this. I'm just basically waiting for more proof of what happened there.
So if we're to believe this happened, we also have to believe that Craig Wright kept the private keys to the 1FIX wallet on his computer behind Calvin Ayer's back the whole time the wallet was in this vault, totally undermining the point of it being held in a secure location. Not only this, this IT security expert entrusted the wallets worth over $1 billion at the time to two cloud storage providers. Not only this, he removed any trace of network intrusion by wiping his computer straight after discovering the hack against police advice. Not only this, he didn't actually inform the police what had happened until the next day, and he's never once asked for help from the public in identifying the gang or publicly called out the police for being unable to catch them. Now, it seems to me that if there's a case to be brought over fiduciary duty here, it's a lack of care shown by Craig Wright towards TTL. He supposedly took it upon himself to look after TTL's money, and yet he's been nothing but reckless in how he's done so. Will TTL ever sue him?
Nah, I don't think so. But, well, unless Ira Kleiman has a bright, quote-unquote, moment, and he comes up with some email and other forgeries claiming that he is the sole owner of TTL and will sue Craig Wright for being reckless with his property. But nah, again, just kidding, Mark. This will, of course, not happen.
No, no, true. The other element to think about here is Calvin Ayer, whose $15 million is now also supposedly gone, meaning Wright can't pay him back because Wright kept the private keys he thought were locked in a Singapore bank vault. If he had any kind of backbone, Ayer would also be suing Craig Wright over this, but those two are protected by sort of mutually assured destruction, aren't they?
Yeah, sort of. Craig Wright depends on Calvin Ayer to keep his standard of living as high as possible. And Calvin Ayer depends on Craig Wright to make him an even richer billionaire with his Bitcoin and blockchain patents, his intellectual property and copyright and licenses, etc. So Craig will not sue Calvin very easily. And Calvin will not easily sue Craig because that means that he is admitting it was all an elaborate scam, a worthless hoax that he bought and sold for many years. Suing Craig would mean that Calvin has written off hundreds of millions that will never return to him in any meaningful way. So yeah, isn't this called the sunk cost fallacy, Mark?
Yes, a perfect example of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Also, a friend of the show, Bit Norbert, made a great point on Twitter. Given that the coins still haven't moved, if the paper wallet really is in the Singapore vault, why haven't they simply retrieved it and used it to move the coins to a new wallet? That would save the day, wouldn't it?
Yep. But yeah, please don't try to discuss this type of simple logic with the BSV, then. They will not understand this.
No. Too much for them.
Yep.
So what's next in the Pineapple Hack case? With the defendants now having laid down the gauntlet for Wright to prove both ownership of the coins and the legitimacy of the hack, we can now expect a series of case management meetings where any advance costs will be laid down and evidentiary discussions can begin. We might even see the first motions to dismiss filed once the evidence is produced and analysed. Arthur, I think there's a fairly strong chance this case gets kicked once the evidence comes in. What do you think?
Well, it might be a bit more nuanced than that. The case actually has two major elements. One major element is Craig proving that he owns Bitcoin that was stolen from him. And that is, of course, most certainly a lost case, if you ask me. But the other major element that might go to trial and to full judgment, even if Craig can't prove that he owns any stolen Bitcoin, is the element of the fiduciary duties of the developers. Do open source developers have fiduciary duties? And if so, in what circumstances? And which duties do they have then? Exactly. So Craig will extremely likely not reap any benefits of a ruling along the lines of, yes, there are fiduciary duties for open developers. If there are fiduciary duties, he will not get his coins back because it will not be decided that he owns those coins. But it would lead to a pretty heated discussions anyway if such a ruling dropped.
As I said earlier, we'll have a full breakdown of the defendant's responses, including some beautifully brutal takedowns of Wright's claims, in our June bonus episode, so make sure you're signed up through Spotify or Patreon to get that the moment it becomes available. Now, we can't leave Lawsuit Corner without mentioning a development that's mere hours old as we're recording this. Craig Wright is on the libel warpath again. This time, the target is Craig Wright debunker Crypto Devil, who, as some of you may know, has helped Arthur with some of his multiple Craig Wright takedowns on Medium. Arthur, this is literally breaking news. What do you know of what Crypto Devil has been accused of?
Yeah, this was, not really shocking, because of course, me and my little group of debunkers, and I consider Crypto Devil as a member of that group that is somewhat ad hoc, but always steadily helping me and always with his own way and his own type of debunks that he is posting on Twitter. His voice is quite loud, and I can understand that Craig Wright is thinking I don't like his voice so much. I mean, I am very to the point, and I don't mind saying the things as they should be called. But Crypto Devil is going even a bit further. So what happened? Of course, the news is a few hours old because Crypto Devil decided not to post about it immediately. Yesterday, he received a letter from Ontier under the Twitter handle Crypto Devil. You have carried out a targeted campaign on Twitter to libel our client by posting highly defamatory and abusive tweets, knowing that they would be read not just by your 581 followers, and it's pretty funny, he does not have many followers, but also by those individuals and entities tagged in your tweets and our client.
Now, and what they don't like, what Ontier is saying, what they don't like is that Craig Wright is called a criminal con man and a fugitive fraudster. The other things that they are asking from him, we require a response by no later than 4 p.m. on the 5th of June 2023. In the absence of a satisfactory response, our client will issue and serve proceedings for libel and harassment upon you. And what they then ask from Crypto Devil is that he is tweeting out an apology to Craig. I was wrong to allege that Craig Wright has committed or otherwise has been found guilty of any offence, whether under the laws of Australia or otherwise, or that he has outstanding warrants for his arrest and is a fugitive from the Australian authorities. I am sorry, Dr. Wright, I will not repeat this libel.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, now yeah, the funny thing is that where other libel cases started in 2019 was mostly about Craig Wright is a fraud and he is not Satoshi Nakamoto, here they focus on the content of that he is a fugitive and that he was found guilty of any offense. Crypto Devil has his own way of saying these things, but he can prove them and why he is saying those things. But I think as we speak now, Crypto Devil is working on a threat. Instead of excusing himself, he is doing a sort of truth defense on Twitter. In a way, he's going to say, go fuck yourself. I'm not going to listen to you. I'm not going to excuse.
Yeah.
Instead, I'm going to prove to you that my wording is correct and that it is correct to call Craig Wright what I am calling him. And if you think otherwise, then disprove my sources and my information and etc. That was the latest thing that I understood from this whole situation.
Okay. Obviously, we'll update our listeners as this unfolds in the coming weeks and months.
Yep.
Outside of Lawsuit Corner, BSV bucked a 3.5-year trend this month when it rose in price against Bitcoin, actually registering a 30% gain in just 24 hours. Driveway enthusiast Joshua Hensley was very excited about this fact, claiming that the spike was caused by people realizing that if ordinals worked on the Bitcoin blockchain, then BSV was inevitably the next port of call for the Bitcoin utility market. This excitement, he said, was giving him sleepless nights, suggesting that a fundamental shift was at play and that the future was suddenly bright again for BSV.
I did not expect BSV and BCH to move decoupled against every other crypto. That is not something I even thought about. But that's what happened. Why is that happening, right? Who did that? Why would anyone, it's going to 29, it's going to $5, right? Right? It might still do that, but why would it?
Arthur, Joshua Hensley wants to know who pumped the price. We got our answer to that, didn't we?
Yeah, sort of. Because we found a tweet, and the tweet was by Calvin Ayer. And Calvin Ayer, he said on Twitter that he picks up some BSV if it dips too low, so they cannot drive it too low. So that could explain this totally organic pump of BSV. And related to that, our friend Hodlnot also came across an interesting anecdote from a Twitter user called Shocked Worlds. This person claimed in a tweet that Robinhood app just told me that one single entity or person owns over 50% of the coins in circulation. And since they were discussing BSV in this tweet thread, we know that it is about BSV. And the suggestion is that Calvin Ayer is this person owning over 50%. But yeah, that's possible, Mark. We don't know.
Interestingly, the long-suffering BSV squad on Reddit wasn't feeling Hensley's optimism over the price pump. One would-be buyer was told to, quote, be prepared for the long-term suffering / waiting instead of get excited by this tiny price jump, unquote, while another warned that, quote, there's always more BSV disappointment right around the corner, unquote. Another said that he was a holder, but, quote, the odds are rather in favour of more downside, unquote, despite the pump, while others noted that liquidity is so low on the remaining BSV exchanges that just a few $100,000 is enough to move the price in such a way. Arthur, did this turn out to be the start of the decoupling and the rise of BSV as Hensley predicted?
No, not at all. Because in the meantime, BSV has already almost fully retraced the whole pump. It went from 0.001 BTC to 0.0016 BTC. Yes, that's a jump of over 50%, 60%. If you were able to catch the low and high on the right times, but the price has now started to touch 0.0011 BTC handle as we speak. So we are already close to back where we started after 2 weeks.
Talking of the rise of BSV, one of the background reasons suggested for this was a supposed partnership with IBM and Gate 2 Chain, a development suite that Enchain recently bought 20% of. Indeed, your friend and mine, Kurt Vuckert Jr., even referenced this in his monthly CoinGeek Q&A.
Can you discuss any notable partnerships or collaborations between companies or blockchain organizations using BSV? The Enchain, Gate to Chain, and IBM people are all chilling this week somewhere talking about something real interesting. It doesn't get much bigger than IBM.
Indeed it doesn't, which makes it strange that such a collaboration has been barely mentioned by anyone in the Enchain and BSV worlds, given that Enchain is notably trigger-happy when it comes to press releases. The reason for this is simple. There is no deal with BSV and IBM. Gate 2 Chain signed up to use IBM's Trace software in late 2022, more than 4 months before Enchain's 20% buyout, meaning that Enchain owns a fifth of a company that uses IBM technology that it had nothing to do with the procurement of. Not quite the same. As for other upcoming enterprise adoption plans, Vuckert Jr. said that there was a, quote, bunch of stuff, unquote, in the works, but he couldn't talk about it. I wonder why. What he did have time to throw out, however, was his vision for BSV's future adoption.
Actually, I'm thinking bigger than that. I'm thinking, when is NASDAQ going to look at the opportunity to make their business more successful by reducing friction, by building it on BSV, building it in Bitcoin script, by using Bitcoin as the lock and the unlock and the broadcast and the settlement of all global trade that's going across their ledger?
Ah. Now, BSV's return to Earth might be disappointing for those long-suffering holders, but it's okay because there was good news to be found elsewhere when hardware wallet maker and PR disaster merchants Ledger added support for BSV. Arthur, tell us more about this piece of good news.
This was such a hilarious non-event. What happened, someone in the BSV community suddenly announced that Ledger, which is a well-known Bitcoin and altcoin hardware wallet builder, had added support for BSV on their products. And the funny thing was, there were even one or two pages on the Ledger website that seemed to support this news at first glance. Until they started to ask Ledger and Ledger support on Twitter, and they were like, we never supported BSV and we are not supporting them now either. And they tried to figure out who made the mistake of putting some BSV information on the website, which was actually there for several months already, they figured out. And they quickly deleted these pages with many excuses online for the mistake. So it was really a non-event.
Okay, so the BSV price might have pumped and dumped, Ledger might have denied any support for the coin, but none of that matters, because crypto exchange OKX this month formally acknowledged that BSV is the real Bitcoin. This was picked up by Twitter user Pleditor, who noted this description of BSV on OKX. Quote, Bitcoin SV is the original Bitcoin. It restores the original Bitcoin protocol, will keep it stable, and allow it to massively scale. Bitcoin SV will maintain the vision set out by Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper in 2008. Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system reflecting its mission to fulfill the original vision of Bitcoin, the project name represents the Satoshi Vision, or SV. Created at the request of leading BSV mining enterprise CoinGeek and other miners, BSV is intended to provide a clear choice for miners and allow businesses to build applications and websites on it reliably. Now, anyone even on nodding terms with this podcast or the involvement of Calvin Ayer in the Craig Wright story might detect the merest hint of familiarity with this heap of CoinGeek-loving, error-strewn word manure. Arthur, the BSV crew must have been excited that OKX was on board with its propaganda. Finally, a win.
A win? No.
Oh.
Nay, it seems that when OKX became aware of the pretty wrong text about BSV on the website, what did they do? They updated these texts to a more truthful description of BSV. And then they also excused on Twitter, like Ledger did. Let me quote one of those excuse tweets. "Hello once again, Predator. We would like to inform that the article has been updated accordingly. Thank you for the heads up and our sincere apologies for the inconvenience caused. We wish you have a great day ahead." Now, and the new version is much more accurate. It calls BSV a fork of Bitcoin Cash, which it is, and says that Craig Wright controversially claims to have invented Bitcoin. And it also criticizes the large block size. Such large block sizes significantly increase the cost of running a node on the network, ultimately reducing the number of users who can validate transactions and the network's overall decentralization. So there we go, Mark. Much better.
With all these victories for his profit-making machine this month, it's no surprise that Calvin Ayer has been in bullish mood, even taking on The Economist when it questioned the success of cryptocurrencies this month in their attempts to spark a financial revolution. He, of course, was talking about BSV and the financial revolution it is setting in motion. It's a financial revolution for him, at least, the kind we saw in 2008. But in doing so, he inadvertently set off a mini illiteracy battle before accidentally telling the truth for a change. A well-known BSV supporter, who has actually started to become more critical of the running of the operation in recent months, replied, quote, "I'll tell you how, because everyone being feed misinformation whilst Craig lets it happen," unquote. The point, which takes a few seconds to figure out, was that Craig Wright is allowing BSV to be denigrated, resulting in a negative opinion to be propagated, and is doing nothing to counter it. Ayer's reply was absolute gold. Quote, "Craig is the world's worst marketing person, so if you are waiting on him, you are dead. He is also not even trying to do that, as he has a day job in vending shite." Unquote. Arthur, you won't find a more perfect summary of Ayer's incompetence and Wright's activities than this, will you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Riddled with spelling errors again, but ignoring the typos, declaring that Craig is inventing shit. Simply hilarious.
Well, that's it for this month's roundup. In case you missed it, this month's bonus episode saw Arthur and I talk to patent attorney David Pierce about Enchain's latest patent shenanigans and his battle to derail its plans, which is well worth a listen to get an idea of what could be coming up in Craig Wright lawsuit land in the near future. Don't forget, too, that next month's update will see us take an in-depth look at those Pineapple Hack arguments and get a firm grounding on where the case will be won and lost. This promises to be a very important case, not just for the Bitcoin world, but development of open source software in general. You can either download these episodes individually from our website or stream our entire back catalogue of bonus content with the Dr. Bitcoin Supporters Club subscription, which you can get through Patreon and Spotify and plug into your existing podcast app. For more information on becoming a Dr. Bitcoin Supporters Club member, which also entitles you to get these episodes a few days before the riffraff, head to our website drbitcoinpod.com, that's drbitcoinpod.com, or see the show notes for more information. Arthur, that's this month's nonsense taken care of. Thanks for joining me once again.
It was a pleasure, as always, Mark.
Indeed it was, and I shall see you for the next one.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice to get these episodes the moment they drop, and if you enjoyed what you heard, we'd really appreciate a star rating and even a review to help us get this out to as many people as possible. Our monthly bonus episodes are available to download from our website for a small consideration, and if you'd like to access all these bonus episodes, plus these monthly updates a few days early and other goodies, you can do so by becoming a Dr. Bitcoin supporter through Patreon or Spotify. See the details in the show notes for information on how to do this, or head to our website, drbitcoinpod.com. That's drbitcoinpod.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at drbitcoinpod, and you can email us at drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. That's drbitcoinpod@gmail.com. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll speak to you again soon.
You've been listening to Dr. Bitcoin, the man who wasn't Satoshi Nakamoto, written by Mark Hunter, with additional material by Arthur Van Pelt, editing and production by Mark Hunter. This has been a Contented Media production.